Hello, it's Friday the 16th of April. I'm Louise Herity and coming up on Playback Daily.
Yeah, we had an alligator come into the pool. The house was like right across the street from the lake. And it's super common here. And the alligator crawled across the road and got into the pool, and then we had to try and get him out. And Justin, one of the guys on the show, was like throwing him fried chicken and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
These things take a very, very long time. There is no need for people to be panicking about this.
I can sense a bit of panic rising, really, amongst the retailers that I talk to in the clothing sector. And they really just need to get some people back in the door.
Zombie house flipping, al fresco dining and getting the garden ready for summer. It's all on the way over the next hour. But first, KBC Bank has become the latest financial institution to announce plans to exit the Irish market. And Mary Wilson spoke to Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue about the announcement on Morning Ireland today.
Good morning, Mary.
Now, you said in your statement on this KBC announcement that it's regrettable, but it is more than that, isn't it? Because on the heels of Ulster Bank's announcement of departure, it's a major blow to banking in Ireland and to consumers for competition and choice.
It's another very significant development in the Irish banking sector. And 2 points I'd make in relation to that is, firstly, I recognise that for the staff of KBC, they're hearing about this for the first time this morning, that many of them are due to begin a busy day at home, trying to get the kids out to school, commencing their jobs, and they're hearing about this development in this way. And I recognise for them that this is a particularly difficult way of finding out about a significant announcement about their future, and my thoughts are with them today. But secondly, from a consumer point of view, it's worthwhile making really clear, as the central bank have already done, that there is no need for existing customers of KBC to do anything, and that all their rights as consumers are fully protected in any scenario. And of course, the development with Bank of Ireland and what they have indicated in relation to the performing loan book of KBC is an important development.
But Minister, is Ireland now an unattractive place for banking?
Well, what we are seeing happening across Europe and across the world at the moment, Mary, is very large banks are looking at consolidations. They're looking at exits from smaller markets and indeed from some international markets. During the night, for example, Citigroup, a huge bank, have confirmed they're looking at their exit from Asia. We've seen large banks such as HSBC make similar announcements. And a challenge that we are facing is for small economies like Ireland, questions are being asked, and then the banks are acting accordingly regarding what kind of profit and return they can make in small banking markets like our own. And this is what NatWest have done, and it's what KBC have now done. But in acknowledging that these large banks are making these decisions, it's also the case that we continue to have large domestic banks here in Ireland that are well capable of meeting the needs that our economy has and providing the credit and investment that we need. But we are seeing a trend here emerge of very large banks make decisions regarding their presence in small economies and deciding to exit, in our case, because they're not able to make the kind of money or return they can make in other parts of Europe and indeed across the world.
So is that an acceptance by you? There's no competition now left in Irish banking. We heard Peter Rubens tell Petula Martin, we have been the competition.
I'm not sure in what I just said to you there that you're able to derive the view that I said there was no competition left. In fact, what I said to you is that we have two large banks, and indeed we have a third bank that is getting bigger, that are well capable of competing with each other and providing choice and competition to consumers. We also have in the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission a regulatory body whose role it is to look after our consumers and to look at the competitive dynamic within really important parts of our economy like banking. It is the case that the competitive dynamic has changed. I couldn't pretend otherwise to you this morning or to your listeners, but it's also the case that there will continue to be really strong competition amongst the banks that continue to be here, and indeed also coming from the many large non-banks that are now coming into Ireland, who don't have branches, who use technology more, who are now providing additional services in a different way to many consumers at the moment.
Can you shed any further light on what Peter Rubens was talking about in terms of the options they're looking at in relation to divesting the non-performing loan book and also reassurance for those whose loans and mortgages are held with KBC?
They are questions that KBC will need to answer and will answer as this process unfolds. But as the process unfolds, in relation to performing loans, they've indicated that they're engaging with Bank of Ireland. And in relation to your question there on non-performing loans, they are looking at options in relation to that. But in any of the options in relation to that, anybody who might end up owning those loans in the future has to respect the terms upon which the loan was made available. And the same rules that apply to Bank of Ireland or AIB or KBC or Permanent TSB apply to all of our other non-banks as well. So we've strong consumer protection in place to protect those who could be in a situation where their loans are sold.
How long has this move been in place, Minister? How long have you been aware of it? And did the impetus for the talks, the memorandum of understanding between Bank of Ireland and KBC now, did that come from Bank of Ireland or from KBC?
Again, Bank of Ireland and KBC are the people who are involved in this transaction. They're best placed to answer those questions from you. I received a phone call last night from the chief executives of both banks at 9 o'clock last night after their boards had met. And they informed me of the decision they had made in relation to the memorandum of understanding. I have been aware for some time regarding speculation regarding the future of KBC, as indeed there was speculation in relation to the future of Ulster Bank. But both those chief executives contacted me around 9 o'clock last night.
And had you anticipated that phone call coming at this time? Were you aware of how advanced this development was?
I had become aware earlier on in the week that there was potential for a development in relation to a decision KBC may make. Mm-hmm. But I was not aware of the scale of what was anticipated or indeed the agreement in relation to the memorandum of understanding between Bank of Ireland and KBC. That has been driven by both those banks themselves. They're involved in a commercial decision in relation to this. And as I said, my key issues now and concerns are in relation to competition and the protection of consumers. But this has been driven by these two banks.
Finance ministers don't like to be surprised. Were you surprised at the speed at which this has developed?
We have been aware, particularly since we had seen the decision in relation to NatWest, that banks are considering their options all over the world. I have seen other things now happen in other markets that continue to remind me that that possibility was there. When I received the confirmation there last night, I think it's fair to say this had moved with a very high degree of speed. And while a consequence of that speed is at least we have clarity in relation to options on Bank of Ireland and the role they may play in relation to the performing loan book, which is to be very much welcomed, I also know that a consequence of that speed is the concern that many now face in KBC and the questions they'll be asked their management today. So this did happen very, very quickly. I have been always aware that as a small open economy, such as the one that we have here in our own country, that it is always going to be a challenge to make sure we can have a diverse set of banks in place.
Okay.
That has changed. It's changed very, very quickly. But there are many other forces in place that are capable of delivering competition and investment now for the Irish economy.
That was Minister for Finance Pascal Donoghue on Morning Ireland. Later on today with Claire Byrne, financial advisor Owen McGee from How to Be Good with Money offered his advice following the KBC announcement.
Yeah, Owen, we want to look at this with you from a consumer point of view, because lots of people waking up this morning wondering what this news means for them and for their mortgage. Should they be worried at this point?
Absolutely not. And like, if we think about it and put this in really plain, simple terms, this is two banks talking to each other about a potential deal. Like, we are much further behind than we've ever, like, than some of these stories that have broken before. Ulster Bank a few weeks ago, it was happening. Like, if you think about how long these things take, Danske Bank announced in 2013 that they were pulling out of Ireland. And they're still here. In small portions of them are still here, but they're still here. It might be 8 years later. These things take a very, very long time. There is no need for people to be panicking about this. This is going to take a long time, for one. But when something does happen, and if something does happen, if you get moved, there's the security in numbers. So you'll get moved en masse. Your mortgage will be moved over to, in this case, Bank of Ireland, if that's what happens. But your terms and conditions will go with you. And therefore, if you continue to pay your mortgage on a month-to-month basis, the terms and conditions that apply to you in KBC will still apply to you in Bank of Ireland, and therefore you've got protection there. So I will spend the weekend now, Claire, answering questions on Instagram to people who are worried about this. There is no need to worry. There's no need to panic. There's no need to make any moves. Now, that doesn't take away from the fact that you should always be looking at your mortgage and your bank account and seeing where it's going and is there better options out there. But particularly people... The customer who I feel most sorry for this morning is the person who's waking up this morning, who is getting their mortgage off KBC next Tuesday or Wednesday to sign for their house. And they're going, what's going to happen?
Well, what do you tell that person?
It's business as usual. There is no reason why you wouldn't go ahead next Tuesday or Wednesday and get the keys to your house and draw down the mortgage with KBC. You will be put into the same pool. There was a reason why you went to KBC, whether it was rate or service or whatever it was, whatever decision you made, why you chose KBC, and you will get your mortgage off them next week. It's still business as usual. Now, we do have to think about the staff, and I'll come back to that in a second, but it's still business as usual. And when this, or if this thing actually happens and you get moved over, you still have the same mortgage that you always had. It's just KBC's name is taken off it and Bank of Ireland's name is put on it. But the terms and conditions are exactly the same. Okay. So please don't worry and please don't panic about it.
But you know, we have seen two players now turn their back on the Irish market. What does it say about what's going on here?
I think it's awful, Claire. Like, if you think about it, not only are we not attractive to international banks to come into Ireland, but the international banks who are already here want to get out. So we are really in a position where it just isn't, it's not lucrative for them. And let's face it, these banks are here to make money. That's what they're here to do. And they're not making money, or they're not making enough money that it's not more attractive for them to take the money that they're putting it into Ireland to put it into another market. And there are lots of reasons, and they've been touched on already. There's things like the really, really awful one, that's the repossessions. And we need to make a decision as a society. Do we want to continue to protect that repossession situation that we have here, or do we want it to change? And if we wanted to change, it might improve rates. Or it may not. It might improve competition. It might bring other people into it. And that's something that society needs to decide, and our politicians need to decide, are we going to go after that? But then there's other elements to it as well. Like, you had Brian Hayes on a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about how switcher mortgages are at 15% of the mortgage market right now. Like, the one thing that drives down competition and drives down rates on the mortgage market is moving from one bank to another.
And that's, we don't do that as consumers.
At the height in 2006, 2007, it was about 40% of the mortgage market. Now, think about how big the mortgage market was, but about 40% of all the mortgages being written in those years were moving from one bank to another. And if we were better at doing that, and I think that, again, needs to look at it. You're talking about a banking forum there a minute ago. Mm-hmm. We also need to look at the legal side of things. If you're in Italy, an Italian bank will look at you. They have central bank rules over there the same way they do here. And your new bank will look and say, well, the last bank must have applied the central bank rules, so the underwriting is much quicker and you can switch it over. But more importantly, the legal side of things, you can do a switcher in Italy in about 6 days, they say. It takes us at least 6 weeks. So we need to look at the whole process, okay, because if we're not going to be attractive, we need to make it more attractive for the banks here to be jumping
all right
from one to the
well,
other.
Owen, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get you back on and we'll do a question and answer session on switching your mortgage and all of the other things that you can do to help yourself in this situation. And we'll do that pretty soon. But for now, thank you very much for joining us.
And sticking with that story about KBC and the potential impact on its Irish staff, later on the News at 1, Brian Dobson heard from John O'Connell, General Secretary of the Financial Services Union, who said that 1,300 staff got the news out of the blue.
totally out of the blue this morning, Brian. Very shocking for the staff in KBC. All the indicators were going a different way. KBC had done some resizing of its branch network. They'd just recently announced the appointment of a new CEO. So nobody expected this announcement coming to the market as it did. Staff in KBC, our members, received that news this morning as they got up, as they had their breakfast and got their kids out to school, mm-hmm. and suddenly a huge question mark over their future. There was a phrase for this back in the 80s, and we thought we'd left those days behind. It was called Rice Krispie redundancies, where people ate their breakfast and heard that their jobs were gone. Yeah. Shocking way to deal with people, and all the more reason I'd endorse the call for a banking forum. There must be a better way to do change in the Irish banking market than this.
All right. We should emphasise redundancies are not being talked about at the moment. People are not at this stage losing their jobs. Clearly concerned, though, if the business transfers to Bank of Ireland, what position they will be in. Have you been in a position to talk to Bank of Ireland, to KBC, to get any indication of what their plans are?
We've spoken to both banks this morning in relation to what their plans are. And we need a statement this afternoon from both banks. And it's a very simple yes-no answer. And that's in relation to transfer of undertakings legislation applying. Is that enshrined in the Memorandum of Understanding? So far today, we've been unable to get that answer. And if you see the statements that the banks have issued, in particular the Bank of Ireland statement, they identified that they'd be very pleased to provide KBC Ireland customers with a good home. And all we're seeking is that staff be treated on a parity with customers, and that the legislation that's in place, transfer of undertaking legislation, is to be applied, is enshrined in the Memorandum of Understanding, and at least provide some initial assurance to staff that are impacted, that if work is transferring, that the jobs will go with the work.
As you said, John, this came as a complete surprise to the markets, to the staff, to it seems, until a couple of days ago, to the minister as well. Are there questions about how this situation has arisen, how this takeover is coming about, if it is to come about?
There appears to be some debate around how it came about. I'm not close enough to I suppose, comment in detail in that, but that requires explanation as well. But our focus today, customers are protected under legislation in Ireland. Staff aren't as well protected. And what we've got to ensure today is to get clear statements from both banks that staff are going to be on an equal par with customers, and that legislation is going to be applied to secure as many jobs as possible.
John O'Connell, General Secretary of the Financial Services Union, on the News at One today. Well, as we prepare for what looks like a summer of dining al fresco, what's the best way to go about it to emulate our neighbours on the continent? On Today with Claire Byrne, Claire spoke to Gina Murphy, owner of Hugo's Restaurant on Merrion Row in Dublin City Centre, and Conor Skehan, columnist with the Sunday Independent.
Gina, I'm going to start with you because you represent 12 businesses where you are on Merrion Row. You've made a proposal to Dublin City Council to transform where you are. Will you set the scene and tell us what you envisage?
Hi, good morning, Claire. Good morning, Conor. Sure. So basically, we are a group of traders on Merrion Row. Merrion Row is situated on the east and north junction of St. Stephen's Green in the city. It's a very busy thoroughfare. We have set up a traders group called Boomer, which is the business owners and operators of Merrion Row. It not only represents the 12 hospitality businesses, but also the other non-hospitality on the street, both at street and first floor level. So basically what we proposed, and we put this into the council last August, is for the pedestrianisation of Merrion Row and the creation of a cultural corridor and a Georgian walkway to link the galleries and the museums and all the historical sites in our area, and that it would become an attraction within itself and a facility and an amenity within the city that would be for everybody.
All right. And Conor, you're concerned that the government might be planning to give away public property to a chosen few for private business gain. Is that right?
Perfectly summarised, Claire. Perfectly summarised.
Tell us why you have those concerns.
Well, I think there's two things. First of all, I think what Gina and her friends in Merrion Row are doing is going to be very welcome as we try to recover from this terrible last 12 months. So anything at all we can do to get ourselves out and about is welcome. And I think the government are doing the right thing to try to help that happen. The worry I have is that when I read the text of the government's proposals, it keeps using the word permanent. And the permanent setting up of the kind of al fresco arrangements, Claire, that you described at the top of the piece, envisages parts of the squares that we've all seen in Spain and Italy and France, where there are tables and chairs and umbrellas and windbreaks permanently in place. They become part of the property of the adjoining business, and they're public space. They've been taken away. So we have the bizarre situation of giving away one of the most precious and literally irretrievable commodities you can have, which is public open space. And we have to do it in a very, very transparent way. And we have to take the thing all the way through.
Conor, I don't know if you're on speakerphone there or if something, if you, there's something you can do with your phone line, but it's a little bit, it's just going in and out. But just to dig down deeper into what you're saying there about this public space becoming a permanent place for people to drink and to dine. What is wrong with that? What, like, what is the problem?
There is nothing wrong with it. It's like everything we do in life, so long as whatever we do is done properly. So we don't drink and drive. We don't give shotguns to babies. So we need to make sure that we are doing whatever we're doing properly in a regulated way. The biggest issue is equity and fairness. And people who are fortunate enough to have a street that's going to end up being facilitated like this is going to leave out 90% of the pubs and shops and businesses who are not so favoured. So what do I say to somebody who's paying rates and they don't get an extra 50% tables? They're the kinds of questions we have to ask. And that's just at the commercial level. There's the rules of antisocial behaviour, which are breaking the hearts of the guards up and down the country at the moment. And then the issues of what you're going to do with the public street for people who might be less able.
So, Gina, what do you see when you think about this plan for the summer, if it happens for the summer? Do you think that this will then become a permanent place for you to use going on from here?
Well, First of all, for Merrion Row, we are looking to do something permanent and turn it into a plaza. But for everybody in the industry, the outdoor dining is a crucial lifeline. I mean, just to give you an example, for myself and my own business, I've only traded 13 out of the last 210 days. Now, I'm typical of anybody in our industry. I mean, how we're all still standing, I don't know. So in order to help us survive, this has to happen. Whether it's a short-term thing or long-term thing is down to each individual council. But with regards to Merrion Row, I mean, we're not just talking about outdoor dining. We're actually talking about a whole facility. And we've had massive support from all our neighbouring streets and our neighbouring businesses that aren't on Merrion Row, who are fully in support of this, because the more it helps sustain our industry, the more everybody gets sustained.
I wonder,
not just about us.
On a very superficial level, what will it be like? Because Dennis Staunton was writing in the Irish Times about his experience in London, where they're already doing this as of this week. And he talks about the windy terraces and the wobbly tables set up in parking spaces, literally in the gutter.
It's not what we're looking at. We actually have a very galvanised plan of how we see this going forward. And we see the use of standardised, dignified, refined seating, uniformed seating throughout. So, for example, outside my restaurant would have the same furniture as Bang or as Eto or Foley's. We would all have the same elegant furniture, elegant parasols. We have also agreed to sign up to a charter of how we operate the outdoor area, and that everybody has to comply to cleaning standards, behaviour standards, everything like that.
So you'll police the patrons on the street?
Well, with regards to our customers, yes, that we would operate it like we would operate our businesses. I mean, obviously, it would be an extension of our businesses. And obviously, we still fall under licensing laws and everything. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what we're trying to do is actually create an amenity that would give space for artists, for musicians, for, a possible farmer's market at the weekend. It's about a whole amenity for the city that's not just for the locals, but also, fingers crossed, Claire, when the tourists come back, we have something beautiful to show them that we never had before, and we're suddenly European.
Conor, are you reassured when you hear all of that? It sounds lovely.
It does indeed, Gina, and good luck with it. But what I keep saying is if we're going to do it, we do it well. It has to have rules, it has to have rates to reflect the additional seats and tables you've been given. And all of us need to be very careful not to put beer goggles on and forget that that terrace that we were on in any of those continental or Mediterranean countries are regulated to within an inch of their lives. And when you actually live in the place, you realise the severity of the regulations and the fact that in every one of those little French squares when we're all out there, there's a big, huge and arm truck parked in the corner all night long to police that. That has to be paid for, that has to be regulated, that has to be agreed to. It's not something that can be done in isolation and definitely not wearing beer goggles.
So if you're a business benefiting from this outdoor space, you have to pay for it, Connor.
Oh, you will have to pay not just for the for putting the tables out, but as a rateable business. We've got to have equity for all of those people who are in the businesses that Gina rightly says have been so hard done by and who are struggling so hard. But it is heartbreaking for somebody who's trying to recover their business and they suddenly see this free goodie bag being given to the chosen few using public space while they themselves are struggling to recover on a street that's not so blessed.
But Gina has said that there are businesses that won't be directly impacted by this, but they're in favour of it happening because it'll attract people in.
Exactly, into those the localised area. The zone of influence for those types of streets extends about 30 metres from the street itself, not much more than that.
Would you be prepared to pay much more, Gina, not just for putting the tables on the streets, as Connor says, but, you know, a good hike in your rates in order to do this because of all the additional costs that will be faced by the state in this one, by the council?
A good hike in the rate, Claire, your guess. Right now, we're not paying rents because we're not even open. First, secondly, getting back on our feet, we are going to need help. It's a bit like riding a bicycle. You know, when you teach a kid to ride a bike, just because you put him into the cycle lane does not mean you take off the stabilizers. We are not able to stand on our own 2 feet at the moment. We need help. So with regards to the rates, while we have social distancing and we cannot operate our businesses as normal, I would hope that there would be some, nice balance found in how we trade outside. But obviously, long term, we have to look at this in a very positive way for the city and its people.
All right. Gina Murphy, Conor Skehan, thank you both very much indeed for joining us.
And from the restaurant industry to the retail sector, retailers in Ireland are calling for clarity on whether they can prepare for a resumption of click and collect from May the 4th. On the News at One, reporter Gail Conway spoke to clothes shop owners in Ennis and Dublin.
I can sense a bit of panic rising, really, amongst the retailers that I talk to in the clothing sector. And they really just need to get some people back in the door, because while they've done their best with the online offering, it's always only going to be part of their offer. They will always rely on their bricks and mortar. Each shop has its own personality, their own way of engaging with their customers. And I know that they're just missing it terribly at the moment.
CEO of Ennis Chamber, Margaret O'Brien, said most retailers in Ennis availed of LEO and Enterprise Ireland supports during lockdowns. But she said the supports need to continue.
This has been a shocking long closure for the shops. And obviously the restart grants are for all rateable businesses in our towns that haven't been able to open since Christmas. So I would hope that there'd be some sort of a restart grant top up stage two. And also for those businesses, depending on the CRSS, that perhaps it would be extended, and for the banks to maybe look kindly on payment breaks. So they're the practical things.
A lot of small retailers around there, large and smaller, are sitting on a lot of aging stock now, and the window for spring summer is starting to close. So, you know, it is challenging. It's really challenging for others.
Willow Boutique in Ennis was already well established online pre-COVID. Owner Jean McCabe said they've managed their stock and sales throughout the pandemic.
Been able to order on WhatsApp, through the phone. We've done personal styling over video calls to help customers that weren't as confident online. And we tried to blur the lines between the in-store service that we provide and the online service.
Jean is aware that some other shops have really struggled.
A lot of stores will be refusing their deliveries. So I've spoken to some wholesalers, and you know the impact is it goes back the chain, so they're also seeing where, you know, shops aren't in a position to take stock, so they're refusing stock, so therefore they're not making their sales, and it's been fed back the chain.
Well, I suppose for some people fashion is about how everything looks, but for a lot of people it's about how it feels. So it's about how they feel in something, and looking at it on a website does not give them any satisfaction. They have to feel it and they have to touch it.
Gwen Culligan, director of County Boutique in Ennis, is keen to offer the personal touch to her customers once again. She said it's been tricky adapting her business, but there were good supports.
Practically immediately we went for the trading online voucher and put our WooCommerce website up with EPOS and linked it to an EPOS system so that we were selling in real time, whether we were closed or open.
A grant for an electronic point of sale system and mentoring from the local enterprise office boosted Gwen's online side of the business. However, she said they've a long way to go before reaching any kind of normal trading levels.
the challenge will be for the next 18 months, once the government support falls away, to try and have the right stock levels in store and to move the stock that we already have. We did not expect to be closed this long this season. We didn't expect to be closed at all. And we didn't buy for a closed shop. And in our particular business, we forward buy. So it's very risky. So we've already placed our orders even for next winter.
Since last month, stores in the Netherlands have been allowed to welcome customers by appointment and under strict conditions. Gwen would like to see a similar system allowed here.
We're hoping that we could just let one person into the store at a time for a browsing appointment. It would be an appointment without any pressure to buy, but they could have a little look around, touch and feel what we have in store and maybe try on if they wished.
Louis Copeland, menswear retailer in Capel Street here. Obviously, last year we took the decision to kind of cut
Louis predominantly sold formal wear pre-pandemic, but now sells 70% casual wear. He's also in favour of the appointment-only system for reopening.
You know, you could control the amount of people you have in the store. And I think people will be happier. They'll be more comfortable coming in that way rather than just a shop open.
Now, all non-essential retailers need are dates from the government so they can plan their next step.
Oh, we had a huge take-up in Ennis with click and collect. I mean, businesses that never thought they'd go that way went that way. So that's critical. And especially for that cohort that haven't maybe revved up to the speed of others with their online offering.
That report was from Gail Conway on the News at One today. Well, we had another teaser of summer this week with the sunshine. And if you're getting your outside space ready, apparently April is the month to move your garden up a gear. Gardeners Mary Staunton and Dermot Gavin shared all their top tips on Today with Claire Byrne.
Well, good morning to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Morning, Claire.
This is the year. This is the year of the garden, wouldn't you say? Mari, is it busier than ever out there?
It is. I was out there this morning trying to dig up some wild garlic. And as much as people say it's lovely in pestos and stuff like that, I don't really want it rampant in my place. But it's, yeah, things are starting to move really fast and you have to keep on it at the minute. So if you have stuff to sow, seeds to sow, if you have stuff to pot up, you need to be doing it now. Okay. Otherwise, it's going to be June so, and we'll be behind.
So if you're not busy right now, Dermot, you're in trouble, is that
well,
it?
That's absolutely it, Claire. But you're absolutely right. It is the year of gardening. More people than ever before are getting out there. They had a taste of it last year and now they want to see through all the growing seasons. So it means this year you really have to be prepared because a few issues in terms of COVID and with Brexit, the supplies we're normally used to just aren't here. So plan ahead.
Okay. And look, people are looking beyond the planting now. They're actually trying to create, from the chats I've been having with friends, they're trying to create a room outside. Isn't that what people are at?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We've all, you know, we want that escape, whether it's from the kids, whether to broadcast a current affairs programme at night, whatever you want to do, you do need, if you have space out there, having a little room in the garden, if it's only a shed that you've converted, whatever it is, to use. The beauty of it is, if you have a place that you work from or you play from in the garden, you get to see your garden every day. So you begin to notice nature, you know, on a minute-by-minute basis. And at this time of the year, everything is changing in front of your eyes. It's exhilarating.
Well, look, let's get to our listener questions because, as always, we've so many of them when we say that you're coming on. And the first one, Mari, is a texter who simply wants to know how to start growing strawberries. And the presenter would like to know that too.
Okay. Strawberries are very easy, to be honest with you. So if you have a little patch of soil in the garden, you make a little ridge, and I always make a little ridge because we have kind of a heavy soil here, so make a little mound and plant your strawberries. You need about four on the ridge, about a foot and a half apart or 45 centimetres, and keep well watered. Now, what's going to happen over the course of this summer is they're going to get pollinated, they're going to produce strawberries, and after that they are going to produce runners. And the little runners can be taken away from the mother plant in October and replanted so to increase your stock. So that's the whole idea.
Okay. Can you recognise those pretty easily as runners?
Yeah. They come off the mother plant in a kind of, it's like a long stem, and then they'll try and root into the ground wherever they want. So your job is to cut them off away from the main plant and replant where you want them. And that kind of increases your stock. The strawberry plants have a four-year cycle. So after 4 years, the mother plant is then ready to be chucked, I'm afraid.
Good night to the mother and you move on. Okay. And just when you're watering them, it's important, is it not, to water the soil, not the plant in this case?
It. Yeah, especially under the leaves because you don't want to damage the fruit. And I always put barley straw underneath the leaves of the strawberries so that the strawberries have something to cushion them from the soil so they won't rot.
Mm-hmm. The problem with strawberries is that other things get to eat them before we do.
They do. Yeah.
That happens all the time. Dermot, this one is about a miniature Victoria plum tree. It's coming into its fourth year in the ground, but the plums have previously all been eaten by some kind of bug. There you go, and end up rotten. Now I have an abundance of buds on the tree indicating potential plums. How do I prevent the plums from going rotten?
Probably more one for Mari than me, but okay. Victoria plum is the only plum to grow. Absolutely brilliant and good to be aware. If you've had that experience last year, it's good to be on the lookout for whatever could be attacking. What would you say it was, Mari? It's difficult when we can't see the plant.
It's a moth, basically. What's happening is the male is flying around looking for the female, and then she's obviously going to lay the egg. So your job is really to put in, it's called a pheromone trap. It's like a little, almost like a little tent, tiny little tent, and you put it in amongst your fruit trees, and it traps the male moth, so then he can't mate with the female, which kind of reduces the impact.
Because it's very kind hard of, for them to mate this year, because coppers is closed.
Oh, dear.
Coppers anyway, is closed. The tent is open.
Come on in. A bit of links.
The Star of Bethlehem, Dermot, will I give you this one about the low-growing patio border and it's self-seeding and it's taking over the raised plot. And this listener wants to know how they get rid of it or control it.
Control it really just by digging it out. It's one of these little campanulas, I presume, that a little alpine plant that will make its way anywhere in any crack or crevice in a patio or in walls or something like that. Some people like them. Some people think they're a bit of a nuisance. I like them. So getting rid of, you know, I think these days, the days of using weed killers or any poisons or anything like that are gone. So getting out with your hoe, taking off the foliage. If you get rid of the foliage of pretty much any plant in the world, it can't photosynthesize, it can't produce energy, so it won't survive.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that, you know, as you say, there are differing opinions on it. I noticed that you posted on Instagram this morning a beautiful picture of hydrangeas, which I think are absolutely beautiful, but they're not everybody's cup of tea.
Well, it's hydrangeas are funny. So I took that picture in Liscannor and County Fair a couple of years ago, and it used to be the type of plant that was known as an old lady's plant, but like dahlias, coming back into fashion absolutely massively, and all the youngsters on Instagram can't get enough of hydrangeas. Very easy plant to grow. If you go down the borings in Cork or Kerry, you will see them growing kind of in ditches, sometimes in semi-shade. They like moisture. They like lots of moisture in the soil. So easy enough to look after. Mm-hmm. The obsession is trying to color, turn one color into another. So everybody wants blue hydrangeas.
Blue.
But you can get anything you want. You can get some wonderful climbing hydrangeas too, and climbing hydrangeas for a north-facing wall.
And Mari, I have somebody here whose hydrangeas are damaged by frost, burned by the frost this week. Is there anything you can do about that, or is it game over?
Well, it depends on how far the frost has travelled down. Look, if it's a mophead hydrangea, the new kind of flower buds could be damaged. If it's Annabelle or, you know, Limelight or any of those, they'll put on more growth and they'll flower on that new growth. Mm-hmm. But the mophead ones are just a bit more susceptible to the frost. That's why really you leave the old seed heads on until the very last minute before the summer.
And the amount of people who are running out of their houses late in the evenings with some horticultural fleece to cover young emerging buds. You know, nature, it generally rights itself, but damage has been done, and that damage can be very bad with some plants. It could stop, you know, something that's coming in, a fruit tree or something like that, producing fruit if the flowers are killed off too
before
early.
Before they're pollinated,
We've been having a lot of frost, haven't we, this month? A lot for April.
A lot. an awful lot. And we're seduced by the good weather, so everybody wants to get out early with their, you know, young
Redding
tender plants. And
you
have to be careful.
Now, there's a hint of desperation off this text, which is why I'm going to go to it next. It's about ashweed. Who wants to take the ashweed question? Because this person wants to know, how on earth do I get rid of it? Please, and thank you with a number of E's.
What's ashweed?
Ashweed, yeah, that's
right. Let's find out what that person means about ashweed.
It may be an ash tree that is seeding itself.
Okay.
No?
Okay.
Not sure. We might try and find out. I'm sure that person can text us back anyway and let us know, what on earth do you mean about how on earth to get rid of your ashweed? I have thyme, says Libby, in a pot. It's 3 years old. It's looking half alive, half dead. Do I cut it back and divide or throw it away?
Well, can I come in on that one? Because we had a really interesting chat with a woman called Jekka McVicker a couple of weeks ago, and she's the queen of herbs. And what she's saying at the moment is that our weather patterns are changing. The type of rain we're getting is kind of subtropical, so it comes down in torrents, and plants like thyme are having a really hard time of it. So the most important thing is that you make sure you've excellent drainage. I would divide it up. I'd divide it up at this stage, but make sure it's not in a, you know, peat-based compost, anything that's retaining too much moisture. Grit around, grit in the pot, and excellent drainage. And of course, it wants to be out in an open, sunny position. Doesn't care about feed. It doesn't need that at all. A wonderful thing, if you can, is to grow a thyme lawn with lots of different, species instead of a normal grass lawn, because that's great for pollinators. But I would divide it, but just make sure where it's growing and what it's growing in is appropriate.
Now, Dan in Limerick, on the pollinators question, Mari, can you ask your garden experts if it's still okay to plant wildflowers, or is it too late?
No, it's still plenty of time.
Perfect
and
time.
The interesting thing about wildflowers is if you have really rubbish soil, they do a lot better, because the grass can't, you know, if the grass isn't growing in that kind of rough area, it's not going to suppress the newly emerging lovely wildflowers. So if you have a grassed area, you're going to have to sort that out by skimming off the grass or sowing a plant called yellow rattle, and that will suppress the grass for you. And then you can sow your wildflower seeds, but also you can grow them on and put them in plugs.
Mm-hmm.
So grow them on and then dig a little hole and put them in.
Now, someone has texted,
or just let an area of your lawn grow and see what happens, because all sorts of unexpected stuff will come up.
Just
and
come up
again,
naturally.
Pollen.
Mm. A listener has been on to say ashweed is another name for ground elder.
Okay.
The joint groan there tells me this is a bad problem.
No, because I have it. So I know exactly what they're talking about now. It's ground elder, and it is crept in from, so I was blamed actually for bringing it into our garden. It takes over the place. The only thing you can do with it is basically tiller it, cut it off, dig it up. The more you dig, the more it breaks. So stop it photosynthesizing is the trick.
Okay.
So
Mari Staunton and Dermot Gavin on Today with Claire Byrne. Now returning to that story of KBC's announcement today of plans to withdraw from the Irish market, Padraig Kazan, a financial advisor who represented hundreds of homeowners with tracker mortgages from KBC and other lenders, spoke to Brian Dobson on the News at One.
Existing customers, if we're specifically talking about mortgages, I would collectively say nothing is going to change other than the owner of the loan. But in regard to ordinary banking customers, a lot will happen there because they'll have to find another bank to do their banking. But I don't think it's even clear yet, Brian, that KBC are pulling out entirely from Ireland, because I've read the documentation that said their investment in their pension side and their banking side, that some form of it is being kept open, but I'm not clear because, as you say, it came as a very, very speedy announcement.
What about, though, people who have got into difficulty with their loans, distressed mortgages? What might happen to them, and what might be the implications of people who are trying to manage those loans?
First of all, in terms of consumer protection, they are protected, and all of the protections afforded to performing loans are also applied to non-performing loans. However, the announcement this morning said it was only the performing loans that Bank of Ireland are looking at in their memorandum of understanding. The issue with regard to loans that are not performing, it's highly likely, similar to what happened with other banks who have offloaded large chunks of these loans, that they'll be sold to what is collectively known as a vulture fund, or some unit that will then administer the fund on behalf of the owner of it, which is the likes of Pepper, is probably the best known to handle the administration aspect of those funds. But they carry on, Brian, as a normal mortgage that will be treated in the normal way, as if it was still with KBC.
But I suppose people who have negotiated maybe some kind of a pause in repayments or interest only or whatever it might be, will be concerned that with the loan going to a new lender, those kind of arrangements could change. They could be under pressure.
Well, I think you make a very important point, particularly about pause payments. The biggest concern I have here, Brian, is the effects and the consequences financially for people out of COVID at a time when now two banks are pulling out of Ireland. That is going to have a huge effect somewhere down the line, because we have not done and sat down about the economic consequences of COVID and how we're going to pay the money back. That is now adding further stress to people who have banked with KBC and indeed Ulster Bank, who no longer have that certainty of relationship. And some of those customers might have been through a very difficult economic time during COVID and are now not going to look very, very presentable to a new bank, which they have to do and find because their current bank is pulling out.
What about the broader implications? One less competitor in the marketplace, bad news for consumers?
I think that's another key and critical area. I mean, we're now down to, and importantly, the three that remain all have a state involvement in those banks. That is not healthy. No matter how many banks are operating in the marketplace, it is not healthy, the position we're walking towards. When Ulster Bank and NatWest made their announcement, I asked and I spoke about and said that there should be a roundtable discussion of how banking is meant to operate and look at maybe a 1, 5 and 20 year view for banking in Ireland. Because while everybody is asking about existing customers of KBC, my greater concern is the customers that still have to come and use the facilities of the banks. The marketplace is shrinking in Ireland. It's a small market for sure. I think discussions need to happen about why we can't access European banks for mortgages and concentrate Irish banking and normal banking world of mortgages and so forth. But you can borrow from France through Belgium, but you can't do it from Ireland. But there's other reasons why that can't happen, which is basically, and the word that nobody wants to talk about, one of the biggest contributors here is the lack and the ability for banks to repossess the properties on loans that run into difficulty. That is a challenge. An added difficulty is the central bank capitalization requirements for those banks is absolutely clearly showing now to be putting huge pressure on those banks deciding to stay or go.
The Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, was making the point this morning that the banking and financial landscape is changing. New opportunities are opening up because of the way the whole financial services industry is changing. But from what you say, because of the particular circumstances that operate in this marketplace, consumers here are unlikely, in the short term anyway, to be able to benefit from that.
I did listen to the interview with the Minister. My concern here is the signals that this is sending to that international marketplace is that the two of the main pillar banks are banks that were operating in Ireland have decided to pull out of Ireland. That is not sending a good signal to Ireland Inc. internationally, about Ireland Inc. internationally. The concern is here a contracting number of operators in the marketplace is not good. That has to be at least discussed. But I said before about the NatWest decision, how strong was this challenged? It isn't easy to unravel a bank and its operations in Ireland. But the signal it has now sent in the last number of months about Ireland and what has occurred in Ireland with Ulster Bank and now KBC deciding that it's better to pull out of Ireland, considering we're a marketplace that tries to attract a lot of foreign investment, those things need to start being married up, at least by discussion, because it doesn't send a good signal.
Financial advisor Padraig Kazan on the News at One today. And finally, to something completely different. On the Ryan Tubridy Show this morning, Ryan spoke to Ashley Casserly, originally from Mullingar, but a reality TV show star stateside, on a show called Zombie House Flippers. I know, it didn't make sense to me either, but it will. Here's Ashley.
So went back and actually went to LA and then lived there for a while and then moved back to San Francisco. And basically I got my real estate license in San Francisco and met my husband, and then we headed over to Washington, D.C. We were there for a few years, and then we moved to Miami and then moved to Orlando, where he's originally from. And so we've been living here since about 2012.
And this brings us neatly to zombie house flipping. Now, zombie house flipping, for those who don't know, is a very popular program in America on the Lifetime channel. And you can follow Ashley on her Instagram, Ashley_Casserly, just to get a handle of what we're all talking about here. But before we get into what the program itself is, you were part of this program. When you got the call as a real estate agent to say, we'd like you to be involved in a TV show, what did you think?
This guy called me kind of randomly and was like, hey, we're going to do a show. We're trying to find the right people. It's going to be called Zombie House Flipping. And I was like, oh, this guy is obviously a scammer. Like, I have no idea what he's on about. And it sounded so bizarre, you know. So I was kind of like, yeah, whatever, and hung up. And then he called back about a week later and was like, oh, we're still looking for people to do this show. Like, he was looking at my website and he was kind of like, oh, house number two would be perfect on the show. Do you know any house flippers? And then I kind of thought of my friend Justin. And so I called Justin and I was like, I think this guy, like, this is a total scam because the shows that he's talking about sound ridiculous. Justin called him back and 5 seconds later called me and was like, oh, we have a Skype interview tomorrow at 11 a.m. And I was like, oh, my God. And so then we did the Skype interviews and we got two more members in the team. And then they flew to Orlando and we did a sizzle reel for a few days.
So a sizzle reel is like an introductory sort of piece of film to pitch it.
Yeah, basically, okay. Yeah. And they rented us kind of a cool convertible car and had drones and cameras, and it was just, like, so crazy because none of us had done that before, you know. And then they sold it to A&E, and then A&E picked it up, and that was 2014, so we've been doing it since then.
Yes, congratulations.
So they just renewed, and now it's season 4.
So on it go. But so I suppose the key to this now is to tell us what it is, zombie house flippers. Well, go ahead.
Well, basically, a zombie is kind of a real estate term back in the day when there was foreclosures because of homes that were left for dead. And so that's where they came up with the term zombie house flipping. And so now every episode, we basically renovate a house that's a zombie. So it looks awful. It's been left for dead kind of thing. We go in and we fix it up. And then at the end, there's an open house and we sell it. And so each episode is a different house.
I weirdly, as somebody who loves Home of the Year and Dermot Bannon's programs, Room to Improve and Goodbye House, this program sounds like it's kind of up my street. So because it's all neat in one episode, is it? You take a ruin of a house.
Yeah, one episode.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And there's a lot of shenanigans. It's more entertaining than it is. You know, you don't really learn that much in it, I'd say. It's more funny Florida style living.
Okay.
Like alligators, okay. That kind of thing, yeah.
Well, because alligators did feature prominently in one particular episode, did they not?
Yeah. We had an alligator come into the pool. The house was like right across the street from the lake. And it's super common here. And the alligator crawled across the road and got into the pool, and then we had to try and get him out. And Justin, was one of the guys on the show, was like throwing him fried chicken and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Now, what people will be curious to know as well, Ashley, is when you get the house, because you're still a real estate agent, I take it.
Yes.
And this is a sort of a sidebar of a job. Would that be right?
Yeah. I'm a real estate broker, so I have agents that work, my company. And then, and then we flip houses kind of on the side, yeah.
So
then we do the show.
And so the houses that you're flipping, are these physically and literally financially your projects? So you're absolutely viscerally involved.
Yeah, so the show like kind of pays us just to be like to film us, I suppose. But then all the money and us buying the houses, that's all on us. So it does get a little bit stressful at times because, you know, Hollywood doesn't really understand how real estate works. And they're kind of like, oh, I thought this house was going to be finished, you know, 3 weeks ago. And you're like, there's planning permission, permits, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of pressure like that. But, yeah, it's all our own money. And then, like, you know, we would only buy it if it's actually going to make sense for us too. So.
Brilliant. One of your colleagues got in touch with me personally to tell me about you. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Was it Justin or...?
And Keith, he's the builder on the show. Yeah.
Oh, tell him I said thanks. But
he's very jealous that he's not on the radio with me.
Come on! But he said in the email that he said he would love to hear Ashley on the radio and see if she loses her American twang and becomes more Irish in our conversation. Are you one of those people? Do you go more Irish when you call home?
Probably, yeah. It's very hard. You know, I used to work as a bartender here, and like literally every American is like, oh my God, I'm from Ireland too. And you'd have to chat to every single person the whole time. So yeah. Sometimes I would just be like, you know, using my American twang a little bit more than
to get out of the small talk.
Yeah, because otherwise you're busy, you know, you can't talk to everybody for hours in west of Ireland, you know.
Indeed. And what do your folks make of your newfound fame in zombie house flippers?
I would say they're probably more impressed that I'm on your show than I have a TV show. So, no, they're grand. I think my mum watches it and my dad watches it. Yeah, they're delighted.
And you've got, you're married and with kids now over there?
Yeah, I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so I've been very, very busy.
You're a busy woman. And how is the American situation between COVID, the new president, relatively new president, and economically and everything? How are you feeling about the world now?
I mean, it's very crazy. It's totally different to what I'm hearing about Ireland. It's you know, in Orlando, especially, the real estate market it's like on fire, and just seems like the economy is doing very well where we are anyway. And, you know, it's kind of, you just wear masks and everyone's getting vaccinated now. So everyone feels very positive over here. But nice. I know you guys are having a hard time. I just heard that they lifted the quarantine for anyone who's vaccinated going into Ireland.
Yeah, it's an evolving situation, but I think it's moving in the right direction, which is good news. Certainly the latter half of this week seemed to be more positive than the first half, which is good. I suppose when I look at America, I was reading a piece in the New York Times at the weekend saying that that demand is exceeding supply at the moment, such as the rush from American citizens post-COVID to spend money. I'm hoping this will happen here for the businesses here, that people come out and there'll be this release valve to say, right, give me everything. Or, you know, I want to buy stuff. I want to get the economy booted up again, rebooted.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very positive here. And I mean, the housing market right now, you can't, I mean, there's 6 multiple offers on every single home practically, you know, that hits the market. So, and it's a lot of, we have a lot of cash buyers moving from New York, as clients from California right now, DC, Atlanta, they're all, you know, they know they can work remotely. So basically they've kind of decided to live in Florida where it's cheaper living. And so, yeah, our economy here is doing great. So good.
Isn't that intriguing that the pandemic has forced people to rethink how they do business and actually then affects migration within a country, because people have learned a lot of lessons from this thing?
Yeah, big time.
Remarkable. Yeah. Ashley, good to talk to you. And thanks for your time today. Continued success.
Okay, thank you so much.
All the best.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All the best.
Appreciate
Ashley Casserly joining us from the United States of America. And our program is called Zombie House Flipping. Which you can watch. It's on the Lifetime channel. And that is a great old yarn from America.
It sure is, Ryan. Well, that's all from me, Louise Herity, on this edition of Playback Daily. We'll be back on Monday. So thanks for listening and have a great weekend.